Hello, and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My voice is a little bit lower than usual today, but we can definitely make it through the whole episode. I'm looking forward to it. Today I have the must list. I have a very large article about F1. As I'm recording it, it comes out on Apple TV next week, and so maybe that has something to do with the timing of their article. And then I have some other smaller bits to wrap us up, including one about the Academy Awards. As usual, I'm reading Entertainment Weekly's content from their website, which is EW.com. Let's get started with that must list. George Clooney leading Jay Kelly, a Brazilian crime caper, and a steamy hockey romance top this week's must list. Jens Lehmann on tour and the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. For every glossy star that graces the screen, there are hundreds of artists toiling away in dark editing rooms and squinting at computer screens to make movie magic possible. These craftspeople don't often get the credit or spotlight they deserve, which is why Entertainment Weekly is thrilled to launch its inaugural The Awardist Makers issue. Please check it out and celebrate the below-the-line talent who go above and beyond for their art. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief, and the main article associated with that is that F1 article that we're going to cover. So the first item on the must list is Jay Kelly. George Clooney knows a thing or two about being a movie star, so who better to play one of the world's biggest? In Noah Baumbach's new Netflix film, Jay, played by Clooney, just wrapped a movie and wants to spend time with his daughter, but she's headed to Europe with friends. So naturally, he secretly follows her. Also starring Adam Sandler and Laura Dern, Jay Kelly is a story of legacy and regret as the star faces big questions about his life and what and who got him where he is. Heated rivalry. In case you haven't seen clips of it all over the internet, a steamy new hockey romance just dropped on HBO Max. The chemistry between rivals Shane Hollander, played by Hudson Williams, and Ilya Rozanov, played by Connor Story, is indeed a big win for everyone. The Secret Agent, the latest and greatest feature yet from Brazilian master filmmaker Kleber Mendoza Filho, is a deceptively breezy and vividly colored crime caper starring Civil War's Wagner Moura. The story gradually reveals itself as a trenchant indictment of political corruption. Jens Lehmann's tour, that might be Jens Lehmann's tour, watching the Swedish musician perform live is like being transported back in time. If you can't catch his last U.S. show in New York City this weekend, Songs for Other People's Weddings is a vulnerable narrative album worth listening to all the way through. And we have the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. The riotous 2005 Tony-winning Broadway musical is back in New York City at New World Stages with a fantastically fun revival, courtesy of a cast that includes Glee's Kevin McHale and Tony nominees Justin Cooley, Lily Cooper, and Jasmine Amy Rogers. They spell it out because it is the spelling bee, but M-U-S-T-S-E-E. That is the must list this week. George Clooney leading Jay Kelly, a Brazilian crime caper, and a steamy hockey romance topping the week's list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So let's take a look at this F1 article, Winning Formula, How Teamwork Got F1, the movie across the finish line. The high-octane Formula One racing film starring Brad Pitt and Damson Idris illuminated how many people it really takes to win the race. The crew working with director Joseph Kosinski were an equally well-oiled machine. This is by Sarah Rodman. With its widescreen visuals, high-volume soundscapes, and pulse-quickening race sequences, F1 the movie roared into theaters this past summer. But one of the film's most pivotal exchanges takes place in one of its quietest moments. Director Joseph Kosinski's deep dive into the world of Formula One racing centered on Brad Pitt as Sonny Hayes, a grizzled but still chiseled veteran driver. The greatest that never was has been pulled back into the driver's seat for one last shot at the glory that eluded him as a young man, thanks to a crash that has haunted him for 30 years. Naturally, he butts heads with a hotshot up-and-comer, Joshua Pierce, played with equal parts sensitivity and swagger by Damson Idris. Near the end of the first act, Sonny is sharing a beer in a quaint English pub with Kate McKenna, played by Carrie Condon. The brilliant no BS technical director for APXGP, pronounced Apex GP, the team he has joined at the behest of its desperate owner, his old racing buddy Ruben Cervantes, played by Javier Bardem. Sonny is trying to both charm Kate and convince her to do a specific upgrade to the team car, and she isn't having any of his maverick lone wolf act. "I have news for you," Kate says, fully in possession of Sonny's number. "Formula One is a team sport. It always was, and maybe that's why you failed at it." It's an interlude that is no less explosive for happening off the track, and when Sonny and the team get their act together to make a run for the championship, it's a perfect analogy for the way the F1 craftspeople, artists, technicians, and crew banded together to make one of the highest-grossing films of 2025, which was also just named one of the National Board of Review's top films of the year. Currently available for purchase on video on demand, F1 comes to Apple TV on December 12th. While the spotlight may shine brightest on celebrated individual names in both arenas, be it a movie star such as F1 producer Pitt or a driver like Lewis Hamilton, who also served as a producer and crucial consultant, there are hundreds of people behind the scenes who help get them into the theater and across the finish line, respectively. Building the power unit. Kosinski assembled his own pit crew to realize his vivid vision of brilliant but messy underdogs coalescing to triumph in one of the world's most popular sports. And it is only growing. According to a Nielsen 2024 Nielsen study, Formula One has an estimated 750 million fans globally, including lots of glossy stars who show up to the races, including Beyoncé, who attended the recent Las Vegas Grand Prix. September 2021, I sent an email to Lewis Hamilton basically saying, "I want to make the most authentic racing movie ever made. Will you help me?" recalls Kosinski of the nearly four-year journey from Lights Out to Checkered Flag. Luckily, he said yes and invited me to the garage at the Austin Grand Prix. As soon as I stepped inside, I was like, "I have to do this." Kosinski knows a thing or two about working in high-velocity worlds. Having directed Top Gun Maverick, he also understands the art and science and value of drafting the right team players, many of whom also worked on that Tom Cruise mega-hit. It's a highly accomplished group that includes casting director Lucy Bevan from Barbie and How to Train Your Dragon, cinematographer Claudio Miranda from Life of Pi and Naiad, editor Stephen Mirone from The Revenant and Birdman, visual effects supervisor Ryan Trudhope from Blade Runner 2049 and Deadpool, supervising sound editors Al Nelson from Jurassic World Dominion and Knives Out, and Gwendolyn Yates Whittle from Tron Legacy and the Avatar films. Re-recording mixers Gary Rizzo from Dunkirk and Inception, and Juan Peralta from Avengers Endgame and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, as well as production sound mixer Gareth John from the Dune movies and The Old Guard. Between them, the assemblage has, among many other accolades, been nominated for 18 Oscars and won half a dozen. And, fun fact, one of them worked on the video for Cisco's Thong Song. Throw in a propulsive score by two-time Oscar winner Hans Zimmer from Dune and The Lion King, and a galvanizing end credits number, Drive, by four-time Grammy winner Ed Sheeran, part of an all-star Grammy-nominated soundtrack, and you've got a formidable formula for creative collaboration. And that list, each member of which represents a larger team, is only a fraction of the number that made a contribution. Faces of F1. Casting director Lucy Bevan is one of the new recruits to the Kaczynski cinematic universe, but she's no stranger to big, boisterous spectacles, having populated the worlds of Barbie and another of 2025's big hits, How to Train Your Dragon. The veteran British casting director made her way to F1 via Jerry Bruckheimer, with whom she had previously worked on Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. "I have always known him to be the most tremendous gentleman and inspiration," says Bevan of the super producer, who has been reliably pumping out blockbusters for over 40 years and previously teamed with Kaczynski on Top Gun Maverick. "He sent me the script and asked if I would meet Joe. I read it and I was really blown away." When she joined the circus, Pitt was already attached, so she was tasked with finding the other members of the company in collaboration with him, Kaczynski, and Bruckheimer. "What struck me about the script when I read it was that relationship between Joshua and Sonny," Bevan says, of the bumpy-to-buddy arc between the drivers. "I thought, what an exceptional role for a young Black British actor. I was so excited by that opportunity." Idris has been steadily making a name for himself in the last decade and is well known to fans of his nuanced work over six seasons on the FX drama Snowfall. Bevan and Kaczynski were excited to give him a bigger platform. "Anyone who watched that show knows Damson is phenomenally talented," says Kaczynski. "I knew from the moment he walked into the room in London and read two scenes for us. I thought, wow, this guy has got it all." "Damson did so well and came through that process, we ended up taking him back to the track to make sure he could drive well enough and," says Bevan with a smile, "of course he could. He had been practicing and he was amazing." As for Apex GP owner Ruben, Bevan says they wanted someone who they really believed could be a true friend to Sonny. Cue Pardem. And to keep Sonny on his toes, they found one of the most amazing theater actresses out of the UK for Kate in Condon. She was the youngest person ever to play Ophelia at the Royal Shakespeare Company. She's just a force, and we just felt she would be a good match for Brad. Bevan can wax rhapsodic and specific about every actor she chose and subscribes to the novel philosophy that whoever is currently on screen is the lead and casts accordingly. "In those moments, those people are telling the story," she says, "of a character who may just have a few lines. It is really important for me to get those roles absolutely right." Which is how she wound up with supporting actors who shine even with limited screen time. Among that group are Will Merrick, who steals every scene he is in as engineer Hugh Nickleby, Samson Keo as Joshua's cousin and manager, Cashman, and Sarah Niles as Joshua's mother, Bernadette, who can be cheeky and nurturing, but also carries a gravitas. "It was just a couple of scenes originally, and she was so great. Joe and Jerry loved her so much, they brought on another writer to grow her part," Bevan says of the actor, known to Ted Lasso fans as Dr. Sharon Fieldstone. Kaczynski was thrilled that Bevan was able to cast a wide net to source a group with a global feel befitting a global sport. "Everyone's got a distinct face and look, and there's a backstory there, and you know how hard they worked to get there," says Kaczynski of the characters. "That's what I saw in the world of Formula One. Faces like that, people who work so hard their whole lives get to Formula One. And it's not just about the driver, but it's about the thousands of people behind them building this car and doing strategy and testing and aerodynamics. I love the idea of kids going to the movie and realizing, even if you're not going to be a Formula One driver, you can still be an engineer or an aerodynamicist or a designer and be in that world, he adds. We intentionally cast team members, actors who are thrilled to be there, make the most of every opportunity, and when they have their moment, they really rise to it, Bevan said with pride. They were able to deal with the high pressure of that world since the film was shot during actual races. No one dropped a line, I'm happy to tell you. View from the driver's seat. F1 marks the sixth collaboration between Kaczynski and Claudio Miranda, while the Oscar-winning cinematographer from Life of Pi says he's not a sports person per se. Kaczynski didn't need a racing expert. He needed someone who knew how to be nimble. Miranda proved that as his director of photography on Top Gun Maverick. It's just problem-solving, says Miranda cheerfully. I'm not a jet guy either, right? The main point from my perspective was how to immerse people in the whole environment of F1. He is a mad scientist in all the best ways, Kaczynski says of Miranda, who previously earned an Oscar nod for another pit vehicle, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. He is also the mystery crew member who worked on the Thong Song video. But first and foremost, he really is an artist. He has a wonderful eye, and we both love the challenge of filmmaking and trying to show the audience something they haven't seen before. On Top Gun Maverick, we wanted to put the audience in a fighter jet, and we worked for a year with the Navy to figure out how to fit six cameras into a cockpit. The pair wanted to do the same with an F1 car, but soon discovered those methods would not work because the cameras were too heavy. So the mad scientist went to work to solve the problem, devise cameras with IMAX quality at a fraction of the size and weight. Oh, and it also needed to move on cars traveling up to 200 miles an hour. A sensor on a stick is what I called it, says Miranda of the camera he worked with Sony to invent and with Panavision to craft a mount. Basically, it's a sensor with a cage around it with a full-frame lens mount, and we were able to cable that to all the brains that were underneath the car. To say that he is underselling how much work and ingenuity went into crafting his creation would be an understatement. The camera, dubbed Carmen in Miranda's honor, took 6 months to build. We had 20 prototypes that Sony shipped to us literally a week or two before we started shooting, recalls Kaczynski. Claudio and his team installed these on our race car and got the controls working. Mercedes built the car for us. So basically, we built a race car made for filming this movie. Without all those geniuses behind the scenes pulling this off, we wouldn't have been able to make it the way we did. It is a miracle because it didn't exist. I think it's going to inform cameras in the future. These things are going to be available for everyone to use now. The camera innovation was just one of many, many solutions that Miranda and his team formulated over the life of the production. Another fun challenge for the crew was shooting at the actual Grand Prix depicted in the film, from England to Abu Dhabi. The crew would have mere minutes at the race to capture Pitt, Idris, and the other actors in the pit crew and Wendy House, those portable buildings where engineering and technical teams monitor various aspects of vehicle performance during the races, interacting with each other, the track itself, and other drivers and race personnel, all playing themselves during real moments like the national anthem and jet flyovers. Most people think when you're filming, you're in charge of everything, this big machine, says Miranda of the crew's typical ability to lock down streets or schedule shooting during favorable lighting conditions. But in truth, in the F1 world, we were a tiny speck. We're doing scenes on the Wendy House, and there's a real race going around. It's interesting to shoot like that. We tried to keep it all visceral and real. That meant everybody had to be agile and fleet-footed. You're not going to have cranes and dollies, he says, of standard gear at a big-budget film's disposal. You've got little handheld rigs that you're just kind of running around with, and you've got to meld into their world because we're their guests. It's just like, this is it. It's shooting now. Point the camera and go. The F1 teams treated their guests with kindness and even made arrangements at the final race to accommodate production to bring all their cars into the pit lane for a red flag recreation. Most people would probably think this is a CG shot, says Miranda, of the moment that includes producer Hamilton and other star drivers getting out of their cars in the background. All the cars were there. All the teams were there acting for us. That was really moving to me. Now you see it, or hopefully you don't. Visual effects supervisor Ryan Treadhope loves it when he and his team successfully create what he calls prove it shots. They're moments where we prove that our cast was in that situation, he says, of a scene where the audience sees something seemingly small, like the image of a car on Kerry Condon's computer screen, or Brad Pitt or Damson Idris's eyes in their rearview mirrors. I grew up in an era of film where the visual effects artisans of the time were really trying to be magicians to create work that was hidden that you believed was real. There are 2,500 VFX shots in F1. And from those fleeting moments to much larger efforts involved for, say, a spectacular crash or changing the appearance of speeding automobiles, Treadhope is thinking about his responsibility to the audience to get things right, particularly the Formula One fans in the crowd. It sets the quality bar really high, not only visually, but also what the content actually is, says Treadhope, who is nominated for an Oscar for his work on Top Gun Maverick. Literally, any time you see the tiny little screen on the steering wheel in the cars, we had someone who knows what they're talking about go through every one of those and say, yep, your tire temperatures look right. Your oil temperature looks correct. There's a joy I take in getting all those little things right and knowing we're being true to the sport and the fans. Joe really set the tone for that in his films. There's a spectrum to the work, from the efforts the team thinks of as getting something quote-unquote right, such as merging different takes for timing and peak performance, to the more complex reskinning of cars on the track or adding tire smoke or dust plumes during crashes to meet the story needs. We had 6 of our Apex GP cars that we built, notes Treadhope. They're all very expensive, and we didn't want to spin them off into the gravel and risk a bunch of dirt and dust getting into the car and into the cowlings and scratching the paint. So we used an F3 car, which is still not cheap, but much, much less expensive, and would film those shots with the stunt driver spinning the car into that gravel, and then we would digitally insert our Apex GP car into the midst of that accident. Treadhope even got to play Mother Nature for the scenes at the Italian Grand Prix in Monza. In the film, it rains. On the day, it did not. It was beautiful the whole time, laments Treadhope with a laugh. The team was unable to access the track in post-production due to scheduling issues, and they didn't have footage of the actors on that track, only stunt drivers. So Treadhope's team needed a way to wet down the roads, insert the Monza backdrop into footage shot at Silverstone, and add the actors. It was a layered process that included editor Stephen Marrone tracking down footage from a year that it did rain at Monza. Additionally, we had developed technology to do digital wetdowns and add all of the mist and water spray coming off the stunt cars. It was a mixing of techniques. You're cutting from a 2019 shot that has real water, but all the cars are digital, to a 2024 shot that we did with real cars, but all the water's digital. You'd swear it rained that day watching the finished scene. Although the VFX team does work throughout the production, the bulk of their magic happens in post-production. Trudhope can't say enough about his fellow craftspeople as well as the cast and stunt teams. We are only successful as a sum of the parts before we take over, he says, tipping his cap in particular to editor Stephen Maroney and, before signing off, encouraging Entertainment Weekly to ask a specific question. Ask him how many hours of footage they had in total for the movie. The number will blow your mind. Quick clip. That number? 5,000. In other words, a lot. By way of comparison, Maroney believes they had about 400 hours for Traffic, which won him an Oscar. They shot 2,500 hours, he says, of the F1 film crew, which was working with multiple cameras. In addition, there was another 2,500 hours of broadcast material from actual races, meaning every time we went to a different track for the practice sessions, the qualifying sessions, and the Grand Prix, we were being fed all the track cameras. While the number is staggering, Maroney and his team did not buckle, devising various mechanisms and lists to organize the footage so he didn't have to go digging every time he needed a specific shot. He knew he had an embarrassment of riches. It was a miracle in terms of what all that footage provided for us, he says. We had hundreds of hours of B-roll for every race where I've got the best camera operators in the world for that particular corner of a track. I could pop around and see all the angles of any given race, including the helicopter footage, which was really fun to watch. While many on the F1 creative team viewed the popular Netflix series Drive to Survive as a gateway drug or source of inspiration, Maroney chose to abstain for artistic reasons. Joe encouraged me to watch to learn more about it, says the racing newbie. I started, but I quickly realized that if I got too involved in the series, which is really well done, it would influence me. Either I'm going to start using the same storytelling techniques, or I might avoid doing something. My approach was, the less I knew about it, was almost better. I wanted to learn it through the script and the performances and the dailies. That way, I'm pretty sure if I understand, then the audience is going to have an easier time understanding it. Maroney, one of the very few people who experiences the films he is working on alone, sees himself as the audience. He realized that if he wanted to give people the in-the-driver's-seat experience, quick cuts in certain situations would evoke that energy. Something I was always really conscious of as I was putting things together was the sense that I always felt like I was getting glimpses of things, he says, of sequences where it cuts from the driver POV or point of view to a crowd shot to the crew at the Wendy house or in the pit lane. Otherwise, you're not living the scene, he says, of the race pacing. You're just watching a race happen, and races are really exciting, but that's not the goal of the movie. You want to be feeling things and getting thrust into different points of view. That was something I was striving for from very early on. Maroney notes that one reason Kaczynski's crews returned to work with him is his collaborative nature, and that even an epic production like this is fun. He particularly enjoyed watching another film crew and Apex GP crew parallel happen as the film unspooled. The final result is important, but for me, it's the experience of working on it that really matters, says Maroney. One of the things I love about the movie and the finished product is the fact that the movie is about teamwork, and I could see the team getting better and better as we progressed, just as they do in the film. I'm not even sure we as a team were aware of it consciously, but I can see that arc clearly now when I watch the movie. Maroney understands that this meta layer may not be legible to the audience per se, but it adds a certain friction for the crew. It's super rewarding to feel audiences responding to that emotionally. "We all know what it's like to struggle," says Kaczynski of the film's aspirational story. "We all know what it's like to be at the back of the pack." For all its whiz-bang inventiveness and speed, Kaczynski had the same ambition going into F1 as he has for all of his films. It always starts with the story, and then you put these hopefully relatable, emotional, entertaining characters in a world that deserves to be seen on the big screen, the filmmaker says. That's what we did with Top Gun Maverick, and tried to do with F1 as well. Give the audience the experience of being in a world they'll never be a part of. Only 20 people get to drive these cars. Lewis Hamilton said to me at the beginning, "I've never seen a film that really captures what it's like to drive one of these cars." That was the bar, and everything we did was aimed at that, and hopefully telling a story that works for people who love racing, but just as important, works for people who don't care about racing. I'm very, very lucky to work with great people, and that's why I generally work with the same people over and over. Many of the people who work on the technical elements of a film log long hours painstakingly getting a single sound or image or edit just so. When they have done those jobs well, often the highest compliment you can pay them is not to notice that work at all. Ryan Treadhope sums up a common theme echoed among his F1 below-the-line teammates. "I actually am most proud when the audience doesn't know that we did anything," he says. "It's not about invisibility to the point where no one gets credit for what they did. It's about when the audience is watching the film in the moment. They're not thinking about us. They're thinking about the story." That was Winning Formula, How Teamwork Got F1 the Movie Across the Finish Line. It was by Sarah Rodman, and it was from Entertainment Weekly's The Awardist Makers issue of 2025. We're a little over our halfway point because that was a long article, and I need to remind everybody that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Next, I have Peaky Blinders. The movie reveals first look, official title, and release date. Netflix has announced that Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, will hit theaters and stream in early 2026. I can't believe that's so close. This is by Mikishana Pierre. Break out the caps, Peaky Blinders fans. Birmingham's most notorious crime gang is back. Netflix has finally announced the release date for its highly anticipated feature film follow-up to the beloved 6-season BBC drama series. The streamer revealed that the movie, now officially titled Peaky Blinders: The Immortal Man, will hit select theaters on March 6, 2026, and land on Netflix on March 20th. The streamer previously teased an epic continuation of the multi-award-winning gangster saga set in the lawless streets of Birmingham in the 1900s. An official synopsis arrived with Friday's release date announcement, revealing that the film will be set in 1940. Amidst the chaos of World War II, Tommy Shelby is driven back from a self-imposed exile to face his most destructive reckoning yet, the synopsis reads. With the future of the family and the country at stake, Tommy must face his own demons and choose whether to confront his legacy or burn it to the ground. The country is at war, and so, of course, are our Peaky Blinders, creator Stephen Knight told Netflix's Tudum. It will be an explosive chapter in the Peaky Blinders story, no holds barred. Full-on Peaky Blinders at war. The British screenwriter's original series followed the rise and fall of the fictional Shelby family, circa 1900s England, and ran for nearly a decade, from 2013 to 2022. Peaky Blinders helped launch Cillian Murphy to even greater heights of international fame, and also starred Paul Anderson, Sophie Rundle, and Helen McCrory. The show's conclusion devastated viewers, but after the series finale ended in June 2022, fans knew they would get at least some form of closure with a follow-up film. We're going to end the series as it is at the moment, but we're going to do the movie, which we'll shoot in 8 months' time, maybe a little bit longer, Knight told Entertainment Weekly in 2021. The Immortal Man will also star Murphy, reprising his role as Tommy Shelby, with Rundle set to return to her role as Tommy's sister, Ada Thorne, and Stephen Graham and Ned Dennehy coming back as Shelby family allies, Hayden Stagg and Charlie Strong, respectively. Packy Lee is also back as Johnny Dogs, a loyal associate of the crime family, and Ian Peck will return as Curly, a horse expert and stable hand for the Shelby clan. The film will also feature newcomers Rebecca Ferguson, Barry Keoghan, Jay Licurgo, and Tim Roth. Tom Harper, who served as a director for several episodes of the series, will direct the movie from Knight's script. The news comes 2 months after Netflix announced that it was also developing a sequel series centered on a new generation of Shelbys. It has already been greenlit for 2 seasons, with Murphy and Knight serving as executive producers. The show will follow the Peaky Blinders movie, taking place in 1953, and chronicle the race to own Birmingham's massive reconstruction project, which becomes a brutal contest of mythical dimensions. This is a city of unprecedented opportunity and danger, the synopsis detailed, with the Shelby family right at its blood-soaked heart. I'm thrilled to be announcing this new chapter in the Peaky Blinders story, Knight said in a statement in October. Once again, it will be rooted in Birmingham and will tell the story of a city rising from the ashes of the Birmingham Blitz. The new generation of Shelbys have taken the wheel, and it will be a hell of a ride. Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man premieres in select cinemas on March 6, 2026, and on Netflix on March 20, 2026. That's Peaky Blinders movie reveals first look, official title, and release date. Here we have Margot Robbie understands audience concerns about Wuthering Heights casting. Trust me, you'll be happy. The Australian star calls her Heathcliff, Jacob Elordi, our generation's Daniel Day-Lewis. This is by Rachel Schufelt. Margot Robbie has noted your concerns about Wuthering Heights. She just asks that you wait for the movie, please. The Australian star has finally decided to address the storm of criticism that has enveloped Saltburn director Emerald Fennell's new vision of the classic gothic romance by Emily Bronte. I get it, she acknowledged in an interview with British Vogue. There's nothing else to go off at this point until people see the movie. The Barbie star thinks that, at the very least, people should be relieved that Jacob Elordi, best known for HBO's Euphoria and director Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, is her leading man. I saw him play Heathcliff, and he is Heathcliff, Robbie said. I'd say just wait. Trust me, you'll be happy. It's a character that has this lineage of other great actors who've played him, from Laurence Olivier to Richard Burton to Ralph Fiennes to Tom Hardy. To be a part of that is special. He's incredible, and I believe in him so much. I honestly think he's our generation's Daniel Day-Lewis. Robbie portrays Heathcliff's lover, Catherine, in this reimagining of the novel first published in 1847. The star of movies such as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Wolf of Wall Street, Suicide Squad, and I, Tonya, noted that while the movie looks sexy, she wasn't in that place in her real life. I was 3 months postpartum when we started shooting, Robbie said, so I was in a very different headspace. I didn't do my usual routine. It was more haphazard, and I remember saying to Emerald, what if I'm not prepared enough? She kept saying, I don't want you to prepare. I just need you to be in the moment, which was a lovely way of relieving my anxiety. It was about being in my body as opposed to my head. Robbie gave birth to her first child, whom she shares with husband Tom Ackerley, in October 2024. Director Fennell, whose previous directing credits also include Promising Young Woman, has said that the story became an instant favorite when she first read it at 14. "I've been obsessed," she said at the Bronte Women's Writing Festival in September. "I've been driven mad by this book. I wanted to make something that made me feel like I felt when I first read it, which means that it's an emotional response to something. It's like primal, sexual." Fennell then said, "If somebody else made it, I'd be furious." Still, Robbie assured Vogue that the movie was in the same category as sweeping love stories, such as The Notebook and The English Patient. "Everybody's expecting this to be very, very raunchy," Robbie told the magazine. "I think people will be surprised. Not to say there aren't sexual elements and that it's not provocative. It's definitely provocative. But it's more romantic than provocative. This is a big, epic romance." Wuthering Heights arrives in movie theaters February 14th, 2026. That was Margot Robbie understands audience concerns about Wuthering Heights casting. Trust me, you'll be happy. And it was by Rachel Schofield. This is the article about the Oscars, sizing up Oscar frontrunners one battle after another and Hamnet, and if K-pop Demon Hunters can slide into the Best Picture race. The road to the 2026 Oscars has started. We're breaking down the frontrunners and dark horses and what's still to come. This is by Jared Hall. Oscar season is officially underway. With most of the fall festivals behind us, frontrunners for the 98th Academy Awards are emerging. Chloe Zhao's Hamnet doesn't open wide until mid-December, but it wowed audiences at the Telluride and Toronto film festivals, winning the latter's People's Choice Award. Several Best Picture nominees have also claimed this prize, including Zhao's Nomadland, which won the Oscars top award at the 2021 ceremony. Jesse Buckley delivers an emotional powerhouse of a performance as Agnes Shakespeare, more commonly known as Anne Hathaway, wife of William, played by Paul Mescal, who takes center stage in this story about the loss of their son, Hamnet. But quickly stealing that movie's thunder was Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Benicio del Toro, Chase Infinity, Sean Penn, Teyana Taylor, Regina Hall, and more. The movie, which opened September 26th, is Anderson's best-reviewed film of his career and quickly catapulted to the top of many pundits' lists. The Best Picture race might be over, to be honest, Entertainment Weekly senior writer Joey Nolfi says of the first Oscar season episode of the Awardist podcast. You can just look at the science of it all on paper. The themes of this film, the characters, revolutionaries, both left-leaning and right-leaning, the political aspect of it all is very timely. There's a lot of really heavy-hitting stars in this, a lot of overdue stars. Joey also cites the movie's appeal to multiple branches of Academy membership, including actors and producers, as a huge boost for its chances. It's one battle after another's to lose right now, and I will not change that prediction unless something comes in and makes me think otherwise, he says. Entertainment Weekly senior editor and self-described awards nerd Joyce Ng agrees with the momentum around the movie and its director and the building narrative that this is Anderson's time. I already have it in first. I have PTA in first. That's Paul Thomas Anderson. I have PTA in first for director, she shares. This was the first movie I saw of the fall season, so like 4 weeks ago, and I immediately loved it. And no shade to the movies I've seen since. I haven't seen everything, obviously, but this remains my favorite of what I've seen this past month. In addition to the movie's timeliness and being highly entertaining, Joyce thinks there's a different aspect of the story that will resonate with voters far and wide. It's really about parenthood, and I think that is highly relatable, whether you have kids or not, but we all have parents, she says. If you've seen the movie, you know there's touching aspects to it and the relationship between Bob and Willa, even if other parts of the movie don't hit with you. As much as the race may seem over at this point, there's still plenty to come, including Wicked for Good, Avatar, Fire and Ash, Marty Supreme, which just had a surprise world premiere at the New York Film Festival, starring Timothée Chalamet, and Song Sung Blue with Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson. But there could be a Best Picture Dark Horse contender in an unexpected pop culture phenomenon that debuted in August. K-pop Demon Hunters. It's hard to call K-pop Demon Hunters a dark horse, but I do wonder if it could enter the peripheral Best Picture conversation. Is that too wild of a thought? He asks. I think the people that are inclined to put this at number one on their nominations ballot are gonna ride for this movie hard. So could there be a moment to sort of, I don't want to say game the system, but I think if you're voting for something that you really appreciate, you're voting for it with all your heart. But for lack of a better term, is there going to be a swell of people that are like, I really think it's important to make a statement and vote for this film? And given its popularity, could it be in the race? Joyce admits she has considered it. If it happens, I would not be shocked, she says, explaining that sometimes it's difficult to pick the 9th and 10th slots in the category. I wouldn't be surprised if the passion for it persists and other things fall by the wayside in the upcoming months. Or, you know, some of these voters have their kids fill out their ballots, their assistants, then maybe they're just K-pop Demon Hunters stans. You can listen to my conversation with Joey and Joyce in full on the Awardist podcast that's linked in the article, where we also discuss the movies that gained the most out of the fall festival circuit and the big contenders still to come, and why Jessie Buckley is still the one to beat for Best Actress. That was Sizing Up Oscar Frontrunners, One Battle After Another, and Hamnet, and if K-pop Demon Hunters can slide into the Best Picture race. It was by Gerald Hall. Let's see if we can get these last two articles in here. They're short. Miley Cyrus shares how fiancé Max Mirando helps her with her unique phobia. It is affecting my everyday life. The Flowers singer revealed that her fear is real and it started during her childhood road trips. This is by Emlyn Travis. Oh, sheet! Miley Cyrus is opening up about her deep fear of paper. The Wrecking Ball singer discussed her unique phobia on an episode of Jimmy Kimmel Live, where she joked that the real reason she got engaged to fiancé Max Mirado is because he handles all of the cardboard recycling outside of their home. I'm known as a little bit of a Grinch because I have a qualm with Christmas. I hate paper. Like, looking at that makes me want to vomit, Cyrus said, audibly gagging as she pointed toward Kimmel's cards. She continued, the real problem for me with paper is when people have dry hands and they touch paper. And then it's Christmas and it's cold and everyone's hands are dry and they're all touching paper. It's gotten to the point where Cyrus can't even open letters from loved ones or read newspapers. It's a phobia, she confirmed, and I need help. Although she noted that some types of paper are okay, like rolling papers. That's fine. First of all, my hands aren't dry, okay? She teased. And neither are the papers because I know you have to lick the paper. Still, Cyrus says her phobia is getting worse with time. There does need to be some sort of intervention, and I am going to look into some sort of EMDR, being hypnotized about it, because it is affecting my everyday life, she says. Someone gets an Amazon box, I'm sick because the cardboard is the worst of it all. It's extra dry and there's packaging within it. She quipped, that's the best part. That's really why I got engaged, because I just make my fiancé open all the packages outside. Jimmy Kimmel, however, had some genuine questions for how this will affect the couple's marriage moving forward. I think the first anniversary is paper or something like that, right? He asked, to which Cyrus simply replied, not there. He followed up by asking if Cyrus will be able to even sign their marriage certificate. This is the thing, like wax paper, anything that's got a smooth surface, that's better, she responded. And from the last marriage to Liam Hemsworth, I think I remember the paper is waxed. Cyrus went on to share that she developed the phobia because her brothers used to traumatize me on long family trips from Nashville to Toronto as a kid. While she might not like the sensation of paper, Cyrus confirmed that she has found other ways of reading books. I was so happy when the Kindle was invented, she said. As long as they're not dry. When I write my book, wax paper, and you can take one page out and roll it, and I won't be offended. We can watch Silas discuss her fear of paper in the video that's linked in the article. That was Miley Cyrus sharing how fiancé Max Mirando helps her with her unique phobia. It was by Emlyn Travis. And then we have this one about Malcolm in the Middle. The revival teaser pays homage to hilarious moment from OG series and confirms release. This is by Rachel Schufelt. It's almost time for more Malcolm in the Middle. A teaser trailer released doesn't offer many details about the upcoming four-part revival of the Fox series, but it does feature a funny nod to a very memorable moment from the original show. The clip features a shot of some hair being shaved off a back in a kitchen, nodding to a scene in which Jane Kaczmarek's Lois shaved the back of Bryan Cranston's Hal. We can watch the video for the revival, which is linked in the article. It's officially titled Malcolm in the Middle, Life's Still Unfair. The cast for the new series includes Malcolm, veterans Kaczmarek, Cranston, and Frankie Muniz, who plays their son Malcolm, as well as Chris Kennedy Masterson, Justin Burfield, and Emmy Coligado. Malcolm's brother Dewey will be played by a new actor, Caleb Ellsworth Clark, as Eric, per Sullivan, is not returning. Cranston explained more about why Sullivan had declined during a June interview on the Fly on the Wall podcast. I talked to Eric, Cranston noted, and I said, hey, we got the show! It's going to come back! He goes, oh, that's fantastic! And I go, yeah, so we're looking forward to having you back. He goes, oh, no, I don't want to do it, but it is fantastic. Sullivan earned only a handful of acting credits after the sitcom as he focused on education. He's actually going to Harvard, Cranston said. He's really, really smart, and he's getting his master's at Harvard right now. He said, oh, God, no, I haven't acted since I was 9 or something, so I'm not into it. Actors joining the cast include Keeley Carsten, Kiana Madeira, and Vaughn Murray. Linwood Boomer, who created Malcolm, will be back as a writer and executive producer, as will producer Ken Kwapis. According to the official logline for the series, after shielding himself and his daughter, that's Carsten, from his family for over a decade, Malcolm is dragged back into their orbit when Hal and Lois demand his presence at their 40th anniversary party. When filming wrapped in May, Muniz shared that it had gone well, to put it mildly. The experience was straight up incredible, like stepping back into Malcolm's wild world, but with all the love and chaos cranked to an 11, he wrote on social media. Reuniting with the cast, getting to know some new characters, laughing till it hurt, and making new memories on set felt like a dream I didn't want to wake up from. It went by so fast, like a blur of perfect moments I wish it could go on forever. In September, the star said fans would find the new series pretty shocking. I think people will be surprised in a sense where everybody is, and the story, but it's only 4 episodes, Muniz said on the Lightweights podcast. It's hard to fit in 20 years of stuff in 4 30-minute episodes, right? But I think people are going to be very happy with what they came up with. During its 7-season run from 2000 to 2006, Malcolm in the Middle won 7 Emmys, including for its writing, directing, and performances from guest actress Cloris Leachman. Malcolm in the Middle, Life's Still Unfair, will premiere in 2026 on Hulu and Disney+. That was Malcolm in the Middle revival teaser pays homage to hilarious moment from OG series, and it was by Rachel Shufelt. Woof, that's all the time. That's it. We're done for this week. Thank you all for listening. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I'll be back next week with more articles, and already I can tell that they're starting to gear up for some best of the year articles, so I'm starting to collect them up. Come back next week and you'll hear some of that. Until then, goodbye.